Welcome to the Blazing Ember podcast, where we aim to amplify the voices of Latino professionals. We, Diana and Maria, founded this podcast to explore unspoken rules and all the ships, leadership, mentorship, sponsorship, and allyship with Latino leaders.
We are here to ignite your path to success with valuable insights. Bienvenidos.
Hello. Today, we're talking with Pilar Ramos, who is General Counsel and Corporate Secretary at Televisa Univision. She's a strategic thinker, an advocate for the advancement of diversity in the legal profession, and so much more. She's a board member at Latino Justice, and she's a member of the Alumni Advisory Board for Inclusion and Engagement at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School, which is frankly one of the longest titles I have seen for advisory boards. I could go on, but really the idea is to get her to tell us the stories behind her success and to share with her some of her secrets, I guess we'll say. So thank you for joining us. And let me start with our first question, which we ask everybody. Since Blazing Ember is based on Justice Sotomayor's statement, we kind of wanted to know, what makes your ember blaze?
I don't know that I can reduce it to one thing, truly. But certainly, there are things that are very core to me, which I think is the point of an ember. And I would say, feeling like you are having an impact, a positive impact on your environment, whatever that environment is. Of course, we have the professional dimension of life, but we have the personal dimension of life. We have the community dimension of life. And there are others. So I would say that's a big, big part. And maybe that's just related to just feeling like you have sort of a purpose in your life that transcends you, you know? Okay. The other thing I would say is learning, because learning keeps you engaged and interested in what's happening in the world and keeps things exciting, you know? So yeah, I would say those two things.
Okay, great. So now I think we'll move into your journey about how you became a lawyer. Tell us a little bit about your in-house roles. We know you worked at Simpson Thacher, and then you joined, and I'm not going to be able to say this, Deraminate?
No, Derrimate.
Yes. Oh, I didn't do it with the Spanish.
Like an auction, Derrimate. Don't you remember? They still exist.
No. They had the gavel. Yeah.
They had the gavel.
Really?
You guys
this
like listening.
This must not be a Puerto Rican thing, I have to tell you, because I don't know what
it's hilarious. It was in Latin America.
Oh, that's so
big. Okay, so. It was big at the time because this was like eBay was coming up. And then seeing Derrimate come up for our market, right, was a big deal. Because guess what? Back then, you couldn't get all your Latin American treats in the U.S. as easily. Now you can Amazon some of them, right? Like it just comes to your house, maybe at a markup, a pretty high markup than your local store.
Oh, my God.
So and this is, you're dating me. You're dating me because this is like at the dawn of the internet. Oh my God.
It's not that bad. It wasn't AOL.
It's like when people would ask you where you work and you would be like at an internet company. the .com, you know, who calls anything a .com anymore? Yeah. But it was the so-called .com boom that took me in-house, and that was totally by life circumstance. It wasn't really part of the plan insofar as I didn't have a plan yet. But life happens and it took me in house, and then I fell in love with it and I stayed in house for the rest of my career. But that's not how I became or why I became a lawyer. I did not even know of this thing called in-house corporate practice. I didn't really know. I mean, I knew the law because of show TV mostly. And I think the only lawyer that like was known in my household was a lawyer, like a local lawyer who did like immigration work, but I didn't know that person. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know a lawyer, but I did understand that it was a profession. I understood that. Mm-hmm. And I understood that, you know, the law is this really like deep philosophical thing that only works if human beings, you know, honor it. Right. And only works if human beings are honorable in coming up with what the law ought to be. Because one of the things that I studied was just this notion of how the world handles itself in terms of, you know, world wars and genocides and all these terrible things that have happened over the course of history and then keeps repeating itself. And a lot of times it was built on the notion of the law being a legitimizer for not good things. So I really was just curious about the law as an instrument for society. I think that's really why I studied the law. I mean, I had also the experience of observing people that I was close to who I had a very high regard for be treated not with great respect simply because they looked, you know, a little too dark or they had an accent or whatever it was. So I think witnessing indignity to someone who you just fundamentally, there's no reason. I mean, not that there ever is a reason to treat anyone with indignity, but I think that fed into it all too. But I didn't know what I was going to do with a law degree. I just knew that I would be probably come out smarter, probably be able to get a decent, you know, job and then really foster that into some kind of a career and be able to pay my bills, which were not insignificant because I had a lot of student debt.
Right.
So that's
in undergrad.
Amazing.
International relations.
Oh, how
and French. So French was because I had grown up in New Orleans and, you know, I already spoke Spanish. So French was kind of the obvious other language to study. And then, you know, getting interested in the world order, you know, you have to study the developments in France and the French Revolution and all that. So then I studied international relations in France, and that was really cool to be so close to so many of the major events that had happened in the more relatively recent history back then. And it was an interesting major because it was one of those that now I think is a whole lot more common of like an inherently interdisciplinary major where you were required to study like a certain amount outside of your major. So I had to take classes in the business school. I had to take classes in political science, which was kind of like the core of it. Mm-hmm. But I had to take like economics and statistics and things that, you know, make the world make sense at the end of the day. So it was a cool major. It was kind of novel. I think it was still novel at the time. And I think it was good preparation for a course of study and then a career in a world that is inherently interdisciplinary.
Right. And
complex.
So you graduated law school and then you went to Simpson Thacher. And what did you practice there?
I was in the corporate group. So my big fork in the road in law school was public sector, private sector. That was the first one.
Yep.
So I looked at that my first summer of law school. I did a internship at the U.S. Attorney's Office. And I thought, I'm going to be a litigator. I knew I was going to be a litigator. And so therefore, I just needed to decide if I was going to be a litigator in private practice or somehow in the public sector. Eventually, because they don't really hire right out of law school, but you have to kind of work it. So anyway, I did that. And I realized they work exceedingly long hours, probably just as hard or harder with fewer resources and less pay than you do in the private practice. But you also see a whole lot more. You see the good, the bad, and the ugly for sure. But you definitely, as a practice, you know, it's a real trial practice. But I also saw that it could be very dangerous personally to the folks involved. And so my equation was just, wow, that's really truly public service. And I want to give back in some way, but I also have like a mountain of student debt to pay. And I kind of want to see the world. And I had seen, you know, Honduras and Puerto Rico at that point. And then I had studied in Europe. But I hadn't really seen the world in grander scale. And so that became a more important part of what I wanted out of a career is to have a kind of a global career where it was relevant for me to be in other markets, in other cultures, in other geographies, in order to conduct business. And so then that kind of had that epiphany. And so I pursued transactional work. And then of the transactional work, I thought corporate work was interesting because so much of the world is about commerce and deals. And I liked doing deals because I thought it was interest negotiation. I mean, really every interaction in life as a human is a negotiation.
I was having this discussion last night with a bunch of professors. Right. About how when I went to law school, which I'll age myself a bit, right? Graduate of 2010, the requirement to learn how to negotiate was not around. I think it's something that may have come about a little bit after my time at law school.
Yeah. So and now it became cool. Yeah.
What did you say?
No, it suddenly became cool. So the thing to do was the practical way to prepare people to be ready to go into legal practice, right?
And it's so necessary. And I was saying the same thing. I say, once you take a negotiation course, which to me came much later in life, right? And you realize that every single part of your day, you know, even personal, even on a personal level, yeah, is a negotiation. You're convincing somebody to do something a certain way. You want to go out to a restaurant, you're negotiating, you're negotiating with your family, you're negotiating with your own clients, even if they're your best friends, you're negotiating with them to avoid risk, to take a certain path because you think it's better, you know, advising them, et cetera. I think you're absolutely right.
Well, and it goes a long way to demystifying it in the sense of, oh, I'm going into a negotiation. If you understand that every interaction in life is a negotiation in some way, then it's not this like big thing to be afraid of. Mm-hmm. And there's just, you know, different types of contexts in which you're in a negotiation, and some you have to be very well prepared for, and others are a little bit more, you know, you kind of know the drill. So I took that class. I did take that class. So this is way, way back, but I think maybe it was because it was an offering at the business school, and okay, it was kind of an obvious thing for a corporate transactional lawyer to do. And it was interesting because I actually don't remember if it was at the business school or if it was at the law school, but was the business school professor that taught it. Oh, but no. what I definitely remember is that there were Wharton MBA students and JD students, and we were kind of pitted against each other. And that was very interesting, actually. Mm-hmm. Many moons later, I did an executive education kind of thing. And it was almost like a 20 years later repeat of that kind of dynamic. Anyway. So
yeah, they even offer actors like to help role play and criticize from the acting perspective, how to coach the skill.
Absolutely. And that the thing is about negotiation is you got to find the win-win, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Why are your friends your friends? Because you get something out of it and they get something out of it. It's a win-win.
Yeah.
Right? The minute somebody's like, this person's kind of low energy, negative energy, whatever, that friendship, you know, starts to fade, right? Mm-hmm. And so I liked that that it was not binary, and that it was about trying to build. So that's why I pursued corporate. And Simpson was one of these big, you know, New York firms, and I think I had good chemistry with the people there. They had a group that focused on Latin America. And so did several other big New York firms. But they were very open to the idea of you can come and do work with our group, but you don't only have to be in this group. You can do, you know, other kinds. And that was I was very aware of this tendency, very natural human tendency that people have to put you in a box.
Yes.
And so I didn't want to be the Hispanic lawyer. I just wanted to be a good lawyer. And the fact that I had language skills, because I spoke Spanish and English and a little bit of Portuguese and French, I didn't want to only work on deals where it was just convenient that I had those skills. And so I was able to kind of move around and experience, you know, purely domestic work, work in Latin America, but also then I transferred to the London office, and I was able to do, you know, deals in France and Sweden, and sometimes the language skills came in handy, and other times, you know, they weren't particularly relevant. And that was just fine. And that's probably true of most of the rest of my career is, you know, it's at the early stage of my career, it's almost like a bookend, although it's not, my career's, you know, not over, but in terms of where I am now, language skills at the beginning of my career were relevant in terms of some of the work I did in Latin America, including when I first went in-house to that Hermatis, which I can speak to in a second. And now, obviously, my language skills are very relevant because I'm working at a company that produces only Spanish language content and distributes it around the world. So, but that's just like life, you know, windows and doors open and you happen to be ready to walk through them. But it wasn't. But
you can't take for granted how strong of a foundation you had for the career for sure. To shape out the way you can, right?
So, This is funny how all these different dimensions of life kind of come together. So I had done some work in Latin America, sure, when I was at Simpson, then I went abroad, then I came back and went back to New York for like a year and then moved in-house. And that was only because my firm didn't have an office in the city where my husband, who was graduating business school at the time, wanted to accept an offer for his like first job post MBA. And so, and talking to the firm, and this is another thing about just fostering like genuine relationships at all levels. I was talking to the, you know, the partners that I had worked with and about the fact that like my husband wants to take this job, but it's in this other city and we don't have an office there. And they were like, well, how about like we introduce you to somebody there who's looking for an in-house lawyer and we'll have your back.
Oh, that's so awesome.
So that's how that happened. They were working, they were underwriters counsel on a proposed IPO. And I was a capital markets lawyer at the time. I did syndicated finance. I did capital markets. I did a little M&A. And I got to mix it up because it was all like global and interesting. But I did not know anything about practicing in-house. And I remember after I gave, you know, and they were like, you can always come back. Okay, great. I remember the days before I started that job, I was like, what have I done? I am insane. I have no idea what I'm about to do. And at that point earlier in my career, I just thought, well, I'll just like over-prepare. And, you know, how do you prepare? That's not something you can learn in a book. You know, you have to live it. So it was two years of very intense. I mean, I probably worked as much or more than I would have at the firm. But the experience was just so different. I mean, it was, you know, now you're a member of a management team, of a leadership team. Now you're managing the board. I was managing a board of like mostly private equity, you know, New York people. We were initially preparing for, you know, public ownership, then the market, the bubble burst, then we had to pivot to more capital raising. So then I was like private equity, you know, lawyer, which I was like, okay, I guess I'm now doing that. And so just, you know, that muscle of being able to pivot and just understanding that that is really the constant is change, and the swiftness with which you can let go of, but the plan was supposed to be X and now the plan has to be Y, yeah. And really just turn your focus towards where you're going as opposed to where you were supposed to be going or where you were. It helps a lot in terms of embracing and really getting the most out of the experience, but also having the most impact. So I think I was, you know, I learned a lot about the commercial transactions and contracts, which I had never done at the firm. But what I really learned was just, you know, what's the P&L? How does the company make money? What are the operations? All the behind the scenes stuff. Oh, we're down. Why are we down? You know, just all of the inner guts of a business, And it was fascinating. I really liked being considered part of the core team, and not just someone that you call, you know, on the outside. So that's really why I fell in love with the in-house world, the in-house practice. And then from there, it was more like, okay, this company has reached a certain maturity level. At that point, I had moved to Buenos Aires, which was another great sort of dimension of that professional experience, is that I also had this fantastic personal experience. And it was time to move back to the States, and it was time to kind of, the sweat equity was like, I had no more sweat in me. I had to, I had to kind of try to find a little more steady eddy. And the company was in a good place. We had just closed around. So I was like, okay, this seems like a rational, reasonable, and thoughtful, you know, time. So I got a call. I was getting calls, you know, and it was just about media, and they needed a Spanish speaker because it was DirecTV. And it was a joint venture, and it was, you know, satellite distribution of content. But I was joining as the corporate lawyer, and it was going to be, you know, they had some interesting kind of internal corporate transactions going on that they were planning for. But then very quickly it became, we're also the exclusive rights holders to the World Cup, which was the one in Tokyo, and forget where else, but it was in Japan. And they had to go and sort of sub-license the rights throughout the region. And so they were just like, all hands on deck. So go do that instead. I mean, you can still do the corporate stuff, and we still need you to do the corporate stuff, but go do this. And I was like, great, except I don't know how to do that. and it was just, okay, but you know, this is like we'll teach you. And you'll also just learn on the job. So we did that. And it was fascinating. And, you know, that was really an interesting foray into a lot of what you see as a consumer, right? Is who is getting content to the everyday person, and who are those people, and how does that all work? So that was interesting. It was also how I got into what became later in my career kind of my main gig, which was interacting with government, and understanding that government may be rational or maybe irrational, because, you know, good policy does not always make for good politics, and understanding that distinction and the impact on the private sector and business. And sometimes, you know, the private sector is lauded for its contributions to society, and other times it's vilified. And in that case, I remember it was what became politicized was sort of the national team, and when, you know, the games would be run, and it was like, oh, you know, we're just going to nationalize the rights to the national team. It's like, but nationalizing the rights is like taking away the value that we intended to, you know, to monetize. Right. So it became a bit of a, there was tension in the system in terms of how to recoup the very significant investments that had been made. But I was a corporate lawyer, so I kind of had a sense of where that was all going to go, and is what ultimately led to a decision to at least entertain other calls, even though I hadn't been there very long. And, but again, it was just a 1 year, but it felt like more because it was so intense. And so I got a call, and I was just like, listen, I want to go to a company that has a consumer brand that means something to me. A company that's not going anywhere where I don't have to worry, you know. I was in my early 30s at that point. So I was thinking about like, maybe I want to start a family at some point. I want it to be truly global, because I'm right now living in Miami, but that's not a forever thing. And I want to be able to live and work around the world. So it has to be a company with a truly global footprint. And so then I got a call from MasterCard, and they had these like two interlocking circles, and they, you know, had the priceless campaign, which was ubiquitous. And they also had the World Cup rights at the time. And, you know, it's a
Did you follow the World Cup rights?
I swear they followed me, because now we're still a World Cup rights holder. And so that just fit that bill really nicely. So I started with MasterCard in the Latin America business unit. I did that for a few years. I got more and more involved in engaging with government, but it was, you know, it was mostly on the back foot in the sense of like something happened and then I had to engage, as opposed to a more proactive approach where you were kind of forging relationships and getting ahead of issues and anticipating issues and really working the relationship between the public and the private sector in a constructive way where there's a public-private partnership to make things better. And I remember having a conversation about that fact, like this should probably be someone's just full-time job because I'm really only playing defense because I'm also dealing with all this other transactional work and labor and employment. You know, I was generalist at that point. And they were like, good idea. Why don't you come do that? And that's really what led to, and they offered it to me the first time and I was pregnant and I was not quite ready to make a move. It was my first baby. And then, you know, you just never know how things are going to work out. A year later, they called and the role was offered to me again. So then that time I took it. I was also pregnant again, by the way. I should mention that because people always ask. It's like I only ever got a promotion when I was having, you know, procreating. But
you're getting two promotions.
So I negotiate. Well, I say it because a lot of times I get questions like, when's the right time? And it's like, just throw that out the window because you can try to plan and there's just, you know, do it because you want it. And then everything else will fall into place. And if it doesn't, you'll figure out how to get it to fall into place. But yeah, so I was like, okay, I want to have my maternity leave down in Florida because it was winter. It was a winter baby.
Good for you.
That was my big negotiation win. And then I moved back to New York. We moved back and then our kids really grew up in New York and Connecticut. For, you know, we were back up there for 15 years, I think, more. And then we just moved back down to Florida, which I never in a million years would have anticipated we'd be back down in Florida, but here we are. And we've been here for now a year and change. So yeah, I was at MasterCard for a long time, 18 years.
So before we go into like your new role, because there's so much to like those 18 years, there's a lot to unpack there, right? Like you don't, I know you can put it in like 2 minutes, Pilar, because you know, you're great at summarizing things. But 15, 18 years, whatever it's been that you spent at MasterCard takes a lot of, I mean, just for just guessing, right? Just a lot of tenacity, grit, willing to change and grow with the times, right? Whether or not you had some experience with sports deals is probably the smallest bit of the skills you needed to be there for so long and to have such career growth, right? Because you went through so many roles and just worked up the legal chain of leadership. And I think it's, you know, I think so far you've given the listeners a lot of tips about, I mean, just how things kind of work out and going with the flow, but you're always building, right? You're always building your career in one way or another and taking these opportunities, even if they don't seem like perfect at the time, right? But you took them with some sort of like, you know, a leap of faith that you took that things would work themselves out. And they have, obviously. But behind the scenes, there are things that you were doing, right? The unspoken rules, the unspoken tips about how to continue growing. What can you tell us about that? Like what skills do you think were crucial to your success at the company, at a company as large as MasterCard?
It's a saying, it's an idiom. I get it. Leap of faith, but it really is a bet on yourself. And one thing I know, and I had learned pretty early in my life and in my career was I am a good learner and I am a fast learner. Because you tend to be good at the things you enjoy doing, right? And so it was, I am going to figure out a way to enjoy what I'm about to do. And another thing that I enjoy is working with interesting, you know, other interesting, smart people. And the greater variety of people that you work with, the more enriching it is. And that means sometimes working with really difficult people, because if you line up, you know, 100 people, you're going to get some difficult ones in there. But that is very helpful in terms of developing a one muscle that you definitely need, which is, you know, how to forge relationships, professional relationships, where everyone's treated with mutual respect, with people who have a different style than you. It doesn't mean they're bad people. It doesn't mean they're mean. I mean, sometimes they are. But for the most part, you know, there's just different styles. They've had their own life experience that has caused them or whatever to evolve into how their style. And I've had my own, right? And that doesn't mean that mine is right. It just means mine is different. And what is the point? And this goes back to negotiation and the human element, is you always have something in common with another human being. If it has to only be at the fact, at the most base level, that they're human and you're human, but usually you can find, you know, many dimensions more where you have something in common with that person. And so it was about looking for that and being in a function that is both an enablement function, because you're helping the business do what it wants to do, supporting it, transacting. But at the same time, it's a control function, right? You're supposed to be there as a sort of ambassador, right, for the broader corporate enterprise and not for any particular P&L or any particular executive, et cetera. And so I always thought that was a really interesting, and that was an experience I'd had very early in my career when I had first gone in-house at this, what was then a startup, where you saw sometimes a tension between, you know, a shareholder interest and an enterprise interest. So when I first moved to New York, well, when I was in Latin America, and this is another thing, you have to become comfortable with the uncomfortable.
Yes.
Okay. So you have to become comfortable with uncertainty, because that's just how life is. And the more comfortable you can get with uncertainty, the more smoothly you will kind of sail through, right? And there's no sailing that happened in my career, by the way. I mean, it was a lot of hard work and grit. But to the extent that you can reduce friction in the system, it helps to kind of just embrace change. It's like, okay, what's coming at me and how can I sort of maneuver and navigate? And so what I realized when in my first job at MasterCard, which was in the Latin America business, was this issue of, we kept having to engage with government and just embracing that. And I was talking to, you know, central bankers and financial regulators, and, you know, they were all like Chicago PhDs. and I had somebody that I worked with very closely on those kinds of issues, who was based out of New York, who had been a long time, you know, lawyer at the company, and I held in very high regard, and was also just an interesting person who really took an interest in working with me on those issues. I mean, he would just send me, you know, like 100-page expert witness reports on this really like complex econometric stuff. And I would read it. And I think he was surprised that I would read it and liked that I would read it and liked that I would ask questions about it. And I remember at one point, you know, saying, well, but what about this? And he'd say, well, that's not our position. And I'd say, no, but I'm just anticipating what the other side's going to say. So I'm trying to anticipate what the counter is going to be.
On both sides.
We had this really interesting symbiotic kind of almost wonky interest in the issues. In addition to serving as ambassadors and protectors, if you will, of the company's interests. And that person played a key role in me moving ultimately to New York, back to New York, I guess, to take that role on globally. Because it was this notion of, this should be somebody's full-time job. And then it was like, oh, good idea. Come do it. And I remember getting that call. It was just that. It was... nobody here knows how to do it. You know, the business, figure it out. That was a huge leap of faith, I would say, on the part of the company to think that, you know, I could do something like that. And that's what you do as a leader. You give people opportunities, and sometimes they're going to hit it out of the park and other times they're not. And you can't abandon them and leave them. It's not a sink or swim kind of thing, but you know, you gotta you got to make those opportunities available. And I was really, I mean, I won't say I was lucky. A lot of people say I was lucky. I really worked for it. And I happened to meet somebody that I found could be somebody that I really could learn from and get good at something with. So that's what brought me back to New York. And then when I thought about that new role and the fact that it was this really global scale, I was like, how do you, this saying of you can't boil the ocean became very obvious to me, like in a very real way. So I was like, how do I go about prioritizing? At that point, there was another senior person who had been a very valuable outside advisor and knew a lot about some of the issues that I was working on and became another kind of teacher. And I think when, you know, when you see a student or pupil, you know, engage with interest and passion and is willing to put the work in to learn it and master it and get better at it. And even sometimes teach back, I think you get a lot of engagement. And so I got that and I was able to, you know, and I remember thinking, how do I go about prioritizing? And I was thinking that through and coming up with a plan. And a lot of it was, well, where are we making big investments in growth? You know, just this kind of basic question about capital allocation. Where's the company allocating capital to grow? And a lot of it was in the developing world markets. I mean, those were the markets where we were expecting to see high double-digit growth. And so I kind of, they say, follow the money. I follow the money. And I said, okay, I'm going to just, this is my hypothesis is that where we're allocating investment dollars for growth, we're going to be hiring staff. We're going to be more present. And therefore we want to protect those investments in terms of the influence that government can have on that investment. And literally they affect the runway and the ROI. So that was how kind of I came up with the plan. And then it seemed very logical when I presented it. It was like, oh, okay, yep, this is where we're putting money. So this is where we should try to get ahead and forge relationships. But then I had to go out and build this function and hire, you know, a team of people who were lifelong partners with government. So it meant I had to hire experts in a space that I was not an expert in. And that was humbling. But I also learned so much from that team. And I also, that was probably the role when I went through all of my leadership bumps where, you know, I had three small kids. I was on an airplane most of the time in faraway places, often for 2 weeks at a time, because that's what I needed to do to be credible with the people on the ground who were running those businesses. And because I bothered to learn the business and the nuances and the idiosyncrasies of those markets, because China's not the same as India, is not the same as Singapore, is not the same as Dubai, is not the same as Nigeria, is not the same as South Africa, and so on and so forth, Brazil and Mexico. They really appreciated that. And you felt like you could engage with them at a deeper level because you had made an effort, you know, to understand what their reality was, what their challenges were. And they appreciated that you were simply offering up to be a resource to help them achieve what they wanted to achieve. So it meant you needed to be in touch with what they were trying to achieve.
I think that's pretty cool. Like listening to you, I'm kind of listening like, well, part of probably what has driven your success is the fact that you've been a good student who's willing to ask the questions and maybe take, you know, make mistakes if that's what happens, right? Like, I mean, what better opportunity to learn than by testing things out and trying things, right? Because you don't know the world. Nobody knows the world at some point. There's just too much world to cover.
Yeah.
And you have to be willing to engage. To learn, right? And I think keeping that ear to the ground is certainly critical in a function like that to know where you need to get your most effort. I think
when you're in a global company and that company happens to be American, you have to be very careful not to come across as imperial.
Yes.
And I think the fact that you can't learn without some aspect of humility, because to learn means you know you're aware that you don't already have that knowledge, right? So there's an acknowledgement of some deficit that you need to then fill with a body of knowledge that you didn't previously have. So I think humility is a big part of it. And also just, keep people are people, keep it real, you know, just talk and don't pretend to know everything. And I think when you engage that way with people, they're much more receptive. So I like that notion of just being a student.
And being authentic, right? You were authentic before it was a thing.
Yeah. Well, and here's the thing, as you're right, 18 years is a long time. Didn't feel like that because I kept changing roles, or even within roles, they were just evolving and changing so much. But I didn't realize that I was such an outlier as I eventually became kind of a more senior leader and then an executive at the company, that there were so few of me. Why? Because, and when I say that, I mean, you know, just other Latina women. Because when I was on the roads for so many years, it wasn't obvious. Everybody was different. And it was an attribute, I think, that I was different, because I wasn't sort of the, you know, person from headquarters who looked a certain way traditionally, that I wasn't an example of the prevailing power paradigm, let's say that. And so that helped me. But then I came back and then I was like, look at me, and I was like, where is everyone? And that's what then led me to get more involved in, you know, the pipeline discussion in the profession, and the pipeline discussion, you know, in the law firms, which is where I most engaged, right, with private practice and what's happening. You're getting this many coming in, but then everybody's leaving, you know, women across everything. And that's just become a passion of mine.
So I'm going to dig us and I'm going to pivot us to another space, because we actually are going to do a part two. So for everyone who's listening, you've gotten a bit of insight into how you got here, right? And what you did. And we're going to talk about your current role, which takes, I think, everything you've talked about and brought it together, but we're going to do that as a part two. So for right now, we're going to thank you very, very much for your insight. If I reflect, I think the transition between a law firm to a practicing in-house attorney. So I have a little bit of a disadvantage because I never worked at a firm, but as I was working with lawyers who were coming with firms, there were so many of them that were not able to do that pivot. They were still firm lawyers, right? I mean, I remember negotiating some where we were discussing whether it should be an and or a the. And I was like, I don't really care. Just pick. Like, it's not significant. So I want to thank you very much. And for our listeners, please, please come back for session two and part two with Pilar Ramos. Muchas gracias.
Thanks for tuning in to the Blazing Ember podcast and our journey to empowerment. Look out for more episodes to keep your ember blazing.
Visit blazingember.com where you can connect with us and share your feedback. Hasta pronto.